There's nothing that'll turn a woman off any quicker than a dumbass.
To the 2023 A Doll Girl episode of the Manor Bun Dispatch. I'm Odysseus, the host, with our co-host Theo. And on today's dispatch, we've got some incredibly interesting guests. We have Dr. Michael Hill, the founder and chief of the League of the South. And we have Christopher Cantwell of the Radical Agenda and the berserker in the courtroom during Sines v. Kessler. Dr. Hill, welcome, sir. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a little about yourself?
Well, thank you, sir. It's good to be on this inaugural show here, and I really appreciate you having me. As you said, I'm one of the founders, not the founder. We had 28 of us, but I've been the chief or officially president of the league since its inception in the mid part of 1994. So that's about almost 29 years. Been at it for a while. It's a grind, but hey, it's something that I'm compelled to do. And I know you fellas feel the same way about this fight that we're in. It's really good to be on with y'all. It's good to be back on with Chris. I met Chris for the first time in the courtroom in Charlottesville and watched with great fascination as he turned those damn Jew lawyers inside out. That was quite a performance, Chris. I was really proud of you for it. But it's good to be on with y'all. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Hill. Chris, same thing, sir. You're quite a noteworthy figure in this white identitarian sphere that we occupy. Introduce yourself, please. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name is Christopher Cantwell, and I was a libertarian, and then I grew up, and then the whole world tried to destroy me, and I wasn't having it, and so we found ourselves in a courtroom where I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Hill. And as I think we'll discuss in greater detail throughout the course of this thing, I had a lot of fun doing that. And so I'm very happy to be with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Excellent. One of the interesting things about this episode and the guests that we have is the juxtaposition of two men who are highly dedicated to this cause, one who's termed a neo-Confederate, the other from northern New Hampshire. I'd like to.
Oh, it's worse than that. I'm actually from New York. I only moved to New Hampshire later on.
Good to know. Now, just to clarify, would that be New York State, or do you actually mean New York City?
I lived in New York City for a period of time, but I'm originally from Long Island.
I'm glad you recovered, sir.
Likewise.
But that juxtaposition, I hesitate to use words like comparison and contrast because you two are certainly not opposites, but there is an interesting, as I said, juxtaposition of Dr. Hill down in Alabama, you up in first New York and now northern New England. Dr. Hill, if you would, please tell us, speak for a moment about what brought you to this movement, what brought you to this cause, where this was instilled in you, whatever you're comfortable telling us about your background that brought you to where you are now in our cause.
I started out my road as a Southern nationalist when I was about 6 years old. My father started telling me stories of the family, and my grandparents did the same, particularly about the Confederate soldiers in our family. So I became a little Southern nationalist at about age six. And when I was 12, thereabouts, my father told me a piece of information that just sort of turned my world upside down and has stuck with me the whole time. And that is that General Patton was right, and that we fought on the wrong side in World War II. And Well, that made quite an impression on a young man who was already greatly interested in military affairs. My father read everything he could get his hands on about World War II, and actually was stationed in Germany right at the end of the war. He went on to do most of his service as a combat infantryman in Korea. But my father is a great influence on me about this. So he turned me into a Southern Nationalist, and obviously that meant that I was a white boy and I was going to do white boy things to please him. And I really always tried to please him because I knew that what he wanted for me was probably the right thing. So I tried to do that, but I wouldn't probably be here, at least in the same manner that I am now, if it weren't for my father and my grandfathers, but particularly my father. And I've been a Southern Nationalist pretty much all my life. And as a Southern Nationalist, I'm automatically a white nationalist because we in the league consider whites only to be Southerners. The rest are simply aliens. So as a Southern Nationalist, I'm automatically a white nationalist, just with a regional bias, I guess you might say. But I've enjoyed this this road that I've been on. As you and I were talking off air, we share a little bit of the same background with our fathers being the way they were and leading us down this path to where we are today. But I'm very happy you did. I find this work extremely gratifying. It's worthwhile. It makes you feel like your life is being used for something positive, and we don't know what the outcome of all this is going to be, but nobody's going to say that we didn't fight. And that's what my father instilled in me. He said, son, you have a duty to fight and God will figure out the outcome of it all. Your duty is to go and fight and do the best you can for your people. And don't bring shame upon yourself, upon your family name, or upon your people or your region. So I've always tried to keep that in mind, that not only that he was watching me, he's been gone now for over 30 years, but I always think that General Forrest is watching too. And man, I tell you what, you don't want to displease men like that. So I feel like I have something to live up to. And I'll try my best to do that.
Yes, sir. I understand that very well. We all believe in certainly the broader cause, the sphere of white nationalists. We believe we've got a people worth preserving, and we, to a man, are certainly willing to make sacrifices to see that happen. Chris, if you would, your path to where we are now is probably somewhat different than Dr. Hill's, although here we are in fairly well the same place at this time. If you're willing, I'd like to hear what your path was that brought you to where you are now.
I'll try to give you a short version. I'll tell for those who are interested to hear the longer version. I actually recorded this as Stage 6, Episode 0 of The Radical Agenda. It's up at ChristopherCantwell.net right now. But in short, I led a life not worth bragging about, frankly. And I ran into a comparatively minor legal problem in the year 2009. And I thought then that I was getting screwed, which led me to research the Constitution of the United States. And when I did that research, I came across a video series by a 2004 Libertarian presidential candidate, Michael Badnarik, who he made the case that basically the vast majority of what the federal government of the United States does is unconstitutional. There's no authority for it in the Constitution. I think he made an irrefutable case about that. And this is what introduced me to libertarianism. And I was enthralled to libertarianism for a few years, but you might say that as a bit of an oversimplification, that immigration made me realize that this was untenable. And so around the time that Donald Trump was running for president, I started coming to this realization, and I started coming into contact with what has been described as the alt-right movement. I was, at the time, I was a co-host of a nationally syndicated broadcast talk radio show called Free Talk Live. But for insensitive racial social media commentary, I was fired. And so the news of this brought me to the attention of a lot more what might be described as alt-right people. They started calling into the show, and I found them very difficult to argue with. And so I have I'm concerned with being right. And so that is what has led me to this place, more or less.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm aware that myself and our two guests were in the same place at the same time at some pretty significant locations during that those heady years, 2016, 2017, before everything changed. Chris, you did share with me something that you filed as soon as you were able to do so. And I took a good read of that document. And as I mentioned, I shared it with our producer and co-host, and I did share it with Dr. Hill as well. Is that something you would like to speak about at all? What you filed looking for some justice in Sines v. Kessler?
Yeah. So for anybody who's not aware of the status of that case, everybody who was just watching the news or whatever heard that there was this like $25 million verdict and said that we lost. And that, I don't think it's really what happened. You know, there were six counts to that action. The first two counts one and two, were federal civil rights conspiracy claims that alleged a racially motivated violent conspiracy. The second two counts three and four, were Virginia state statutes, Virginia civil conspiracy and the Virginia hate crime statute without any element of conspiracy to it. And the Virginia civil conspiracy, we could have been found liable for violating any one of half a dozen different state statutes. And the final two counts, five and six, were only against James Fields. And though I believe that James Fields is an innocent man, and I think it is a terrible thing that has befallen him, there wasn't a whole lot you could do for him on account of his guilty plea in a federal court. So the first two counts, they didn't find a verdict on. They deadlocked on that. And the second two counts, they found us liable to the tune of millions of dollars, but the vast majority of this verdict actually was attributed to James Fields. Now, that's very significant because the Virginia hate crime statute can find you liable for racially motivated violence, vandalism, or harassment, okay? So to simplify that, the first two counts required a racially motivated violent conspiracy, and the second two counts could have been racially motivated harassment, which, depending on your view of the world, somebody could assume that our demonstration, our speech, constituted harassment of the people of that city. And I think that was a widely held view in the city of Charlottesville, as it were. And so the lawsuit was not predicated, though, on a theory of harassment. The court said over and over again in all of its decisions, we're not talking about First Amendment protected activity. We're not talking about your speech. We're talking about the violence. And so if they didn't find us liable for a racially motivated violent conspiracy on counts one and two, it seems that they held us liable for something else on counts three and four. And if that's the case, then they're holding us liable for something we weren't sued for. And that's not a legally viable verdict. And so a verdict is not a judgment. A verdict can be set aside by a district court judge. And I'm asking the judge to do precisely that because there's no accusation against me that I harassed anybody, much less Devin Willis or Natalie Romero. These are two of the defendants who were present. They were the only two plaintiffs, I should say, who were present on August 11th at UVA, who were claiming to have been, damaged to the point of requiring an emotional support animal on account of what happened at that demonstration. But both of them claimed that they had been injured in some way. But under cross-examination by me, their attorneys never asked them who injured them. I asked them. They tried to suggest that perhaps it was I who hurt them. And then we went over the video and I said, show me the part where I hurt you. And that specificity was not forthcoming. And so there's no accusation that I or any other defendant said or did anything to these two people. And yet those of us who were present on August 11th were held liable to the tune of millions of dollars over that event. And of course, all of us were held liable for some kind of civil conspiracy over the course of the 2 days of what happened down there. Now, if you don't find us liable for a racially motivated violent conspiracy on counts one and two, and you hold us liable for something entirely different on counts three and four, well, that's not what you sued us for. And my argument is that the judge should set the jury verdict aside on account of that. And I sincerely hope that he does. Should he fail to do that, I have other arguments in that as well, which is specific to the terms of my confinement. When I was arrested in January of 2020, I was a pro se defendant. I couldn't pay my attorneys because the plaintiff's calumny destroyed my business. I was shut out of payment processing and all of this stuff, and I couldn't make money. And then when I got to jail, my financial situation most certainly did not improve. And so I was a pro se defendant, and the plaintiffs kept on emailing me instead of contacting me at the jail where I was at. So I was left out of the loop on the litigation for 14 months. And then when they got caught doing that, they sent me a 2-terabyte encrypted hard drive and said, yeah, go ahead, get caught up. And I'm like, well, that's not going to happen. I have maybe an hour of access to a computer a day. I'm not going to be able to do this. And I told the court that, and I moved to sanction the plaintiffs, which they denied. Shortly after I get this hard drive, they ship me to a CCA, a private prison facility in Tallahatchie, Mississippi, Corrections Corporation of America, which was a hellhole. And they said, oh, yeah, you can get this hard drive sent to you by your lawyer. At which point I spent the next month trying to explain to these people what a pro se defendant was. And they did not seem to understand this. And before I could exhaust administrative procedure there, they shipped me to the United States Penitentiary in Marion, Illinois, where they put me in something called a communications management unit, which your listeners can find out plenty about if they do a little research on it. It's like we call it Gitmo North, the little Gitmo. You know, a lot of my neighbors were named Muhammad, and they tightly restrict your communications there such that it was prejudicing my defense. It was making it impossible for me to participate in litigation, which I kept informing the court of, and the court kept on ignoring me. And so, you know, I really didn't have the time to prepare for trial, especially with these expert witnesses of theirs, who I only found out about when the court decided on my co-defendant's motion to exclude them. So I have some things specific to me that if the court declines to set aside the verdict and dismiss the case or order a new trial for all defendants, that the court should order a new trial for me specifically on account of the plaintiff's misconduct and that of their good friends in the United States government who interfered in the litigation. And so that's the primary thrust of the arguments in the document I sent you.
Well, may justice be done. Dr. Hill, as we know, the league had developed a template that up until the morning of Charlottesville worked pretty well. One of the places I alluded to earlier where we were all in the same place at the same time was Pikeville, Kentucky at the end of April 2017. And at that location, law enforcement at every level did what we always expected them to do in this country, which is uphold the law and enable us to exercise our rights. That changed on the morning of August the 12th, 2017 in Charlottesville, Virginia. Dr. Hill, the league was one of the significant defendants in Sines v. Kessler. And I'd like you to speak to the extent you're willing about the effect of the verdicts and the judgments on the league. And again, to the extent you're willing, the status of the league at this point in time, sir.
There's no doubt that all the controversy around this has cost us some members, particularly those with faint hearts, who thought that they were somehow going to be pulled in on any judgment that might be brought against the league. And as Chris pointed out a minute ago, you know, this is kind of still hanging over our heads. We, you know, had this $26 million judgment collectively against all the defendants. And as Chris pointed out, most of it is against James Fields, and they'll, of course, never collect a penny from him. But, you know, to my knowledge, the judge hadn't rendered any verdict about who owes what in this. So we're sort of in limbo right now, but we've forged ahead doing what we can. But I'd be lying if I said it hadn't had a negative impact on us, because we've lost members over this, from those who feared getting tangled up in the legal stuff going on subsequent to Charlottesville, and those who didn't like the fact that we were getting active in the streets. You know, actually, we started getting active in the streets back around 2012 or 2013 and did a lot of stuff all across the South. But that was before Antifa and Black Lives Matter really got organized. We'd run into some, you know, faggots on the streets in college towns who would be out there with bullhorns, you know, trying to annoy us. But it wasn't anything serious. The first serious thing that we ran up against regarding Antifa or Black Lives Matter, as you know, Adethius, was when we went to Pikeville, and about 20, maybe two dozen of us stood there in the face of maybe 500 of them waiting on our reinforcements to come a couple hours or so later. But yeah, you're right. The cops did their job in Pikeville. And a week after that, about 75 of us in the league went to New Orleans and stood up for the Lee statue there as a symbolic act. You know, we knew they were going to take it down, but we were going to have our say before they did. And we faced down about 1,000 Antifa and Black Lives Matter folks in the streets of New Orleans with 75 of us. And as I tell people, the cops saved their asses that day because they didn't want any part of us. We had some big, big, strong boys there. But the cops did their job there and in Pikeville, too, as you pointed out. We got to Charlottesville, and it was a different story. And that made a lot of our people, I hate to say it, a little bit nervous. They didn't want anything to do with the street activism. All they wanted to do was have conferences and listen to speakers and, you know, stuff like that. And I told them, I said, well, we're moving into a new phase of activism here. And we did. But Charlottesville has hurt us. I mean, there's no way around that because we lost considerable number of members on it. But we're building back, and we got some plans for 2023 that will take us out into the streets, but I'm not going to give those away.
Well, Dr. Hill, thank you for that. That kind of brings me to something that's been on my mind for quite some time. Charlottesville was the paradigm shift. A few months later, we did White Lives Matter in Shelbyville, Tennessee. Law enforcement very zealously did their jobs that day. There was only one arrest that day of an Antifa who infiltrated behind the lines of the Nationalist Front. It was completely different from Charlottesville. But I think we all acknowledge that that was the end of activism in that form, at least for the time being, where prior notice is made, a permit is applied for, the advance notice gives Antifa and Black Lives Matter an opportunity to turn out and destroy a small town. And something that I think we've all noticed and commented on, you know, outside of our sphere, and certainly the law enforcement and the various authorities who pay attention to elements such as Antifa and Black Lives Matter, the general public, I don't think they had any understanding, certainly of who Antifa is. If I remember correctly, Black Lives Matter arose in the wake of that Trayvon Martin killing when he forced a homeowner association, I guess, neighborhood watch to shoot and kill him. And after that, BLM grew up. And of course, the media can't resist the opportunity to publicize that sort of thing. But Antifa was a great mystery to the general public. After the summer of 2020, that isn't the case anymore. Antifa is certainly known. Black Lives Matter is certainly known. I lost track of how many cities burned that summer. And if we're willing to posit that Shelbyville was the end of that form of activism, certainly without getting into any particulars of future plans, Dr. Hill, what form do you see activism, what we used to call kinetic activism, what form do you see that taking now and in the near future, sir?
Well, probably the same as we determined would be effective after Shelbyville. You know, they pinned us up there, and of course they pinned up Black Lives Matter and Antifa across a four-lane highway from us. And consequently, you know, that there was nothing happened there like it happened in Charlottesville, but at the same time, we couldn't get our message out to the people that we wanted to receive it because we were simply isolated. And we as you remember, after that, we took stock of the situation and said, this is a template that's not going to work anymore. So we started doing the flash demonstrations where we simply showed up at a place like Knoxville. And I'm sure you remember that operation well, because it was tremendously successful. That worked. And we started doing that for a while. We went to generally smaller towns and had some really good success with that. I imagine that in the future, we're going to do something along those lines in a similar vein, where we simply show up and spend however long we need or however long we're allowed to before the cops run us off, handing out literature and showing the flag, as it were, and trying to get our message out to people in small communities and rural areas. We had one of these, a couple of these earlier this year. where we went to rural areas, crossroads out in the middle of nowhere, where you had a lot of traffic, say on a Saturday morning, and we'd hand out hundreds and hundreds of pieces of literature. And normally the cops would come by and just say, hey, what are you guys doing? Make sure you stay out of the road. Don't cause any problems with traffic, et cetera. So we're going to be doing things like that. I guess for lack of a better term, you just call them flash rallies. But you're right. I mean, if you make something, make an announcement, you get a permit, and Antifa and Black Lives Matter are going to show up and they're going to wreck a town or wherever. And we're going to get at least part of the blame for it. And that's not a positive thing for us. So we'll be doing the flash rally thing for a while.
Yes, sir. Chris, yesterday off air, you and I discussed the fact that activism in that previous form really no longer carried the potential reward or the potential results to warrant the risk to our individual men's freedom and well-being. You participated in a fair bit of activism. You've got your finger on the pulse of the white identitarian sphere, I think, as well as anyone does. What form do you see activism taking now and in the near future?
Well, just to be clear, in the time that I've been in the communications management unit, I really haven't had my finger on the pulse of this thing. It's been impossible. I know from what I know of the last year, I know from Fox News and talk radio, which, as you're aware, is not going out of its way to publish the internal workings of our thing yet. But I don't think that there's necessarily a safe way for us to do these things. There's a level of danger involved when you're challenging the established powers, let's say. And so I'm not averse to people risking all sorts of things, but there's got to be some kind of risk versus reward ratio that warrants the risk. And my experience has been that we've suffered tremendous costs and the benefits have been, I don't think, have measured up. And so my thinking on this, and I don't want to discourage what Dr. Hill's talking about. It sounds like he knows what he's doing and he's managing to keep things safe. But my thinking prior to listening to that, in any case, was that I'm not sure that street demonstrations are particularly useful. I disagreed, I'll say, in the wake of Charlottesville. You know, there was a lot of people saying, we got to get off the streets. We got to get off the streets. And at the time, I disagreed with that. I said, no, if you reward these people with success, it will get worse. And that is precisely what happened. And now it has gotten worse. And I think that while it is unfortunate for our country in the short term, I think that there is a benefit to us in that when we more or less got off the streets, these maniacs, they didn't stop with us. You know, they went after regular people, you know, moms going to PTA meetings or whatever. And so that is something that kind of forced the regular public, the people who are not initiated into, you know, what we're concerned with, that sort of forced them to reckon with who these people were that attacked us in August of 2017. And I think that in the long run will have some benefit to us. I think that what I've been able to watch from, you know, so-called mainstream media, I don't know if you consider talk radio mainstream media, most of them wouldn't, but from, you know, commercial media ventures in any case, is that our ideas, maybe not things on race explicitly, but I think the Overton window, so to speak, has shifted pretty dramatically rightward, and that is a very good thing. And that is influencing the Republican Party, and that to find ways to continue that rightward drift is the project before us at this moment. And that's the project that I intend to try to engage in. And I think that probably involves some tact, I think. I think that probably involves some interacting with people who are not necessarily initiated into the things that we are, and not pushing them to become so initiated in the immediate, trying to shift the Overton window in a more I don't know. The word I want to use is progressive, but that has a connotation to it that doesn't apply to what we're doing here. But in a more gradual way, which I think has the potential to influence the levers of power more than street demonstrations.
That is something I've noticed. I mean, there are a lot of gatekeepers, but a gatekeeper implies that there's a gate that you can walk through if you have the ability to not necessarily dialogue with the gatekeeper, but be able to respond correctly to the gatekeeper's dialogue to bring people through the gate that they're trying to keep out. I remember this was something either you said a long time ago or wrote about, the benefits of infighting. I think this was still back when you were in the libertarian phase.
Yeah.
I think I've been following you since even before you appeared on Free Talk Live. It was basically the idea of where infighting can be good publicly is when it's a framed conversation, because that's what the whole dialogue between the fake left and the fake right is. It's a conversation framing. So it means if you're not on the one side, then you're kind of automatically defaulting to the other. So yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense with that Overton window pushing, trying not to scare too many people. But I did have one question on activism for both of you. And that's, like, I guess the first one would be, what do you think actually encompasses, when you say activism, like what all falls into that category versus other positive activity that is not technically activism? And then the second part would be following up on that is, what is the concrete goal, either immediate or long-term, of activism? I know in On Guerrilla Warfare, Mao talks about military action being the means by which you attain a political goal. Now, we're not doing military action, but the point is that there's always a concrete political end in the immediate end, in the long term, for specific activity in the real world, in this case, activism. So I'd say those would be the two questions. What actually encompasses activism, especially, you know, post-Charlottesville? And two, what are the immediate and long-term goals of activism, whatever that actually means?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and throw this out there. Activism should be a broad spectrum approach here, I think. We tend to think about activism as simply being out in the streets. And of course, that is certainly part of it, and has been and will be, I think, to continue. You know, a lot of people like to say, draw this dichotomy between what they call in real life stuff as opposed to stuff on the net. You know, I'm just as alive when I'm sitting at my computer or on my phone as I am when I'm out in the streets. So both of them are real life stuff. But I think, you know, I'm not saying that we ought to do one and cast the other aside. I think we can use them both. The real concern here is reaching people. Sometimes you can reach people better face to face, but it's a slower process. It may be a more effective one in the long run, but it's slower and you can't reach as many people. We need to be flexible enough to use the technology that we have, like we're using right now. And we also need to be able to go out in public and face to face, talk to people, hand out things, give them something to read, talk to them, answer their questions, go speak to groups. I think the goal, the long-term goal, is to make mainstream these ideas that we hold. And that shouldn't be that hard to do. I was born in 1951. I can remember a time when the ideas, many of the ideas that we have right now, were commonplace among average people. That can happen again. We need to mainstream our ideas and get them to the point where our people, the white majority, although it's shrinking, we still are a majority. We're the white majority of common sense people look at us and say, yeah, those people are speaking my language. And whether we're doing that out in the streets, whether we're doing it at, you know, face-to-face gatherings, or whether we're using the marvelous technology that we have today to do it, I don't see that matters. As long as we can mainstream our ideas and make people see that they're the only way that whatever we have here, this polity that we call the United States of America, whatever it turns out to be, is run by rational and sane people using rational and sane ideas that have been the underpinnings of Western Christendom for hundreds and hundreds of years. I guess mainstreaming our message, and that's, I think that's a very doable thing.
I'll jump in there and I'll say, I think that I agree with Dr. Hill's aim here, which is to mainstream the ideas, and that the purpose of said mainstreaming, in my view, is to carry those ideas into action through public policy. And what I've become convinced of in recent years is that street activism, I used to think that street activism was a thing that powerless people did to obtain power. I have become convinced that it is precisely the opposite. I think that street activism is something that powerful people do as an exercise of their power. And that is why the Antifa can run riot and burn cities down and murder people and set courthouses on fire and not go to prison. And that the purpose of them doing that is to show us that they can do these things and not go to prison as a demonstration of their power. Street activism can certainly serve that other purpose, which is, you know, for example, handing out literature is a means by which to reach people. I think that, you know, literature drops are probably, I imagine that they are probably one of the more effective things that we can do, you know, to use the phrase. I agree with Dr. Hill's assessment that it's probably overused, but in real life, out in the street type things. You know, if we go somewhere and we grab microphones and speak our piece, I'm not sure how many people are listening to that. I think that the power dynamics are such that the street demonstrations are an exercise of them. And so the question in my mind becomes, how do we obtain that power that we can have these demonstrations? And that, I think, is a fairly complex subject, and I don't necessarily know the answer to it. What I do know is that this January 6th thing has gotten the attention of people who do have power. Maybe their power is limited. It's a faction of the Republican Party, but they are not by any stretch of the imagination powerless people. And people like Mitch McConnell are trying to render them such. And that those people, that faction of the Republican Party, is a, in my mind, a prime target for influence. And that the goal at present, I think, is to seek conduits to that faction and seek to influence it and see what we can do to ally ourselves therewith and to make them more powerful as our conduit to power is the thought process I'm working on. And as you're probably gathering, it's not particularly well developed.
Allow me to pose a question. Yes, the Overton window has shifted mightily. We've even got a well-known black rapper speaking positively about Adolf Hitler. That shifts the Overton window in and of itself. We need a third party. We need a third way. Sometimes I hear that called being a third positionist. And 100 years ago, in a country the size of Texas with a homogenous population and an embittered population of recent war veterans, a man went from giving speeches in bars, serving 2 years in prison, to taking total state power 10 years later, and his positions were set in public policy at that point. How do we take advantage of the current circumstances with the Overton window shifting? What we call normies, I think we all understand what that term means, knowing exactly who Antifa and Black Lives Matter are and what they represent. What is the path for us to emulate, hopefully, what was accomplished in a much smaller country, a whole different set of circumstances, but yet in a 10-year period, what they thought was impossible happened? How do we do that? How do we take state power? Legally, I want to be clear about that, legally. And is there a political solution? And if so, what do you gentlemen think that might be?
Well, I believe that there's a great opportunity here. And I look at this, obviously, as a Southern nationalist from a more regional point of view. But I think this idea would be applicable to any region in the country. And I think Chris is absolutely right about this, that there right now is a war going on within the Republican Party. And I've never been a Trump supporter. But I do realize the value of having somebody like that on the political field out there, because I don't know what all he is, but I do know that he's made the right enemies to some degree. And his MAGA movement is bringing normies out by the tens of thousands to his rallies, which shows me that there's a lot of political discontent out there. And I think that the mainstream Republican Party has shot themselves in the foot, and I don't think they'll recover from it. I've been involved in the past in trying to put together third parties. We had an attempt back in the 1990s to put together a Southern party, and it was sabotaged from the inside by the feds. There was all kind of wrangling. But even when we got beyond that, the stone wall we ran into was ballot access. The Democrats and Republicans have that sewn up. If there is a political solution, and I'm not saying that there is or there isn't, I don't know at this point, but anyone who wanted to try a political solution, I think the Republican Party is going to be ripe for the taking here within the next 4 to 8 years because of the things that are being exposed right now. Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, all of the GOP standard bearers, as it were, have been discredited and disgraced, and they're being more so every day. And I don't think people are listening to them anymore. I don't think Donald Trump is necessarily the future of this movement, but he's come along and done, I think, a few very important things, most of which, in my opinion, is getting people to distrust the mainstream media by calling them fake news and liars, which we've all known for a long, long time. But I'm very optimistic about the political scenario out there, even though I don't necessarily think that politics as usual, as we've been, you know, used to seeing them for the last, you know, in my case, 60 years, is going to be what I'm talking about. I think we're on the cusp here of a new political dynamic in the United States. And I think we have an opportunity, if we watch it closely and intervene at the right time, and as Chris pointed out, to open some conduits to some of these dissatisfied MAGA type people out there. I think that there's a possibility of destroying the current GOP, which has always been one of the things the League wanted to see in the South, is the destruction of the Republican Party. I think we may be on the verge of seeing that beginning to happen here very soon.
Well, I agree wholeheartedly. Dr. Hill took the words right out of my mouth that Donald Trump's most important contribution was to discredit the mainstream media. That information stranglehold that they once held is so rapidly falling apart. And I think especially with the recent revelations of the so-called Twitter files, namely that the FBI was actually working at Twitter and that they paid them $3.5 million and the CIA was involved and they were conducting explicitly psychological operations on the platform, now discredits even the social media sphere. Which I think is so tremendously important. And I don't think that would have been possible, or at least that would not have come for a much longer time. And a great deal more damage would happen before it was done had Donald Trump not accelerated that process. And so I'm thankful to a 45th president for that. I certainly don't want to see the destruction of the Republican Party, although maybe the Republican Party as it exists today might no longer be, and, you know, completely different people were in control of it is certainly something that I would I could tolerate, to say the least. I don't think that our politics, I don't think our political system in the United States is permissive of a third political party. I don't think that that's a realistic objective. And I spent a good deal of time as an activist with the Libertarian Party, and whatever you can say about libertarianism, you know, they've been around for a while, you know, and maybe their ideas are partly to blame for their failure, but it's not simply ballot access. In New Hampshire, you can get on the ballot pretty cheap. I mean, you pay $200, you can run for governor. There's an entire apparatus. There's an entire structure around a political party. And When people say the Republican Party this or the Republican Party that, I think it's almost like when libertarians complain about the government, right? The government has no inherent will of its own. It's just a matter of who's in charge of it, who's making the decisions, who's pulling the levers. And what I would seek to see happen is for our people, or people who have been influenced by our people, perhaps preferably, to be in those positions of power. And I think that the way that our politics in the United States are structured today, that there is a two-party system, and that two-party system actually exists for reasons that are not always obvious, but they're not, it's not without its reasons. You have a left-wing party, the Democrats, and then you have a wholly inadequate right-wing party called the Republicans. And I think that we are rapidly, we are right now passing through this window of opportunity to influence that party. And as Dr. Hill mentioned, you know, Mitch McConnell et al. Have been so thoroughly discredited. I think that especially with the Senate race in Alaska, you know, Mitch McConnell pouring millions of dollars into that thing to see Lisa Murkowski reelected when you knew that a Republican was going to win. It was just which one. And he said, well, you know what I really want? I want Lisa Murkowski. And that tells you everything you need to know about Mitch McConnell. And people who are not at all sympathetic to our ideas are capable of seeing that much. And if we are participating in this replacement of the current, for lack of a better term, establishment, if we are participants in the conversation of, all right, Mitch McConnell's out, who's in? Our window of opportunity is in that discussion. And we, our best, my thinking is anyway, that our long-term political interests are best served by doing what is necessary. And I'm entirely certain what it is, but whatever is necessary, even if it's not, you know, walking up to the people in the room and being like, hello, I'm a white nationalist, or, hey, have you heard about the Jewish problem today? Whatever it is that we have to do to participate in that conversation, that's our greatest opportunity to carry our ideas closer to public policy. And that if we don't start wielding political power, we're not going to be able to do anything at all, because I think that we're heading for, we're rapidly moving towards an illiberal politics. People that don't view freedom as the object of their political discourse anymore. They're trying to reasonably, I'd say, find a stable, reasonable order that they find tolerable, and they're willing to coerce their fellow citizens to accomplish it. And so if we're not at the, if we're not at that table, then the illiberal politics that we're going to get are going to be this left-wing compulsory transgender nonsense. And so our goal is to get a seat at the table.
I would have a question on some of that, where I think you're right about the fact that it's not just about ballot access. There are so many different levels at which the two-party system is it basically enshrined in everything that we do. I think the only time there's been some meaningful supplanting of a major party was actually with the rise of the Republican Party, but that involved a lot of industrial donors and Abraham Lincoln and a massive crisis point of the country. But when it comes to the acquisition of political power, I mean, that's all in the forming of coalitions that have something to offer as well as demands to that they would want to accomplish. Like, coalition building is just how power has always worked since the dawn of civilization. You know, even the so-called absolute monarchs were not truly absolute in their rule. Just because they're one person, they can't physically do everything. And so anytime you're negotiating with anybody, there's going to be some power negotiations involved. And some of the things I've seen both today and a little bit in the past with, I know, white nationalism or any sort of meaningful dissident movement in America in, you know, post-World War II, is that it always seems like it's an organization or a group of people who are trying to be a brain and a mouth for a body that is dead or doesn't exist. And that's all, even now, it seems like that's a similar thing to, I mean, what we're dealing with today, where we have groups of people who are trying to, like you said, move the Overton window, mainstream our ideas. And then it seems like people are trying to skip. I don't know. It feels like they're skipping steps almost. I don't know what those other steps that are being skipped are, but suddenly that people believe what we know, and therefore suddenly we have political power. I don't know. It doesn't seem like there's an actual body politic of white people who are white on purpose to effectively give the substance that would be required to do white politics. And I'm not sure how to get from, I guess, step one to step three there. So what would, especially since, you know, Dr. Hill, you've been obviously around for some time in this, and Chris, you've done plenty of reading yourself and had plenty of experience. So, I mean, what would your thoughts be on that? Like, when it comes to, I guess, some of the maybe mistakes or lack of accomplishment in the past and the present, and how to connect those dots. Sorry, that was a little rambly, but.
Well, I can tell you how some of the problems I've run into over the past 30 years. You can go out and make the most eloquent argument to someone for your position, and mine would obviously have been the Southern Nationalist position. And you'll have people agreeing with you and saying, yes, you're absolutely right about that. I can't disagree with you about it. I love that idea, on and on and on. But at the end of the day, these people have a stake in the current system, and they're afraid to do anything that would really have an effect on it. And when I say the system, it's everything from the job that they hold to their Social Security benefits, to their Medicaid, Medicare benefits. The whole system has them entangled in it. And even though they know that your ideas are good, and even though they know that the country is on the wide road to hell, they just cannot let go of this idea of they have a stake in the system, and they're not going to bite the hand that feeds them, even though that hand is feeding them poison that's slowly killing them as whites. They simply can't come to terms with breaking away from a system that has given them something for the promise of a system that might require them to sacrifice even to the point of their own blood, because there's obviously a system that's going to be defended by some very powerful people. They won't let it go without a fight. I think you're right when you mention, you know, sometimes there's a mouth and a brain, and what we're trying to do is to find a body for it. But that body out there is going to have to experience some hardship. I've always said that most people are not going to become Southern nationalists, white nationalists, dissidents, whatever you want to call us, until the wolf has come to their door personally. And, you know, the wolf doesn't come to everyone's door at the same time. So what you have is this sort of piecemeal thing of people becoming activists when they've seen that there's really no other way for them to go that makes any sense. If something could happen, if there could be an event that drove a lot of whites to the same realization at the same moment, in other words, the wolf comes to a lot of doors at once, then I think we could really get some traction here. But I'm not saying an event like that will happen. In fact, I could see several events looming on the horizon that could be that event. But I just think we have to be patient, not meaning we sit around and twiddle our thumbs and hope for something to happen. But I think we just have to keep hitting the pavement every day, as it were, with our message, pushing it, not getting frustrated until the tipping point is reached. And I believe it will be. I think the enemy, as it were, has pushed this thing too far. And I think they're in a panic mode. I think they realize that they've made mistakes that they maybe can't recover from. We just have to be patient. I think our day is going to come, as Chris said, but we just have to be patient with people. That's all I know. I've been doing this for almost 30 years, this particular thing with the league, and it does get frustrating, but I don't have anything else to do. So I'll continue.
I think that the event to which Dr. Hill is referring is ongoing. People are scared. People are, for the first time, I think, really conscious of what's going on at the border, especially if they're watching Fox News or listening to any media right of the Washington Post. And so the January 6th thing has been given sort of a special place in the minds of a lot of people who would not be sympathetic to us. They are witnessing what they see as political repression. They're uncomfortable with it. And so the wolf has gone knocking on some doors for sure. And I don't think that this is something that happens to, say, an electoral majority of people. A dissident is by definition a political minority, because if he was the political majority, then of course he'd be wielding power and he would have nothing to dissent from. And so my thinking on this is that, as I said, finding these conduits into people who already have their foot in the door of power and sort of all try to squeeze through this turnstile, so to speak, is what I think our aim is. And that might be a little bit repetitive of what I said before, and I apologize for it, but that's my thinking of it, is that the opportunity that these events are ongoing. I think that people are coming to seriously doubt the outcome of the 2020 election, that they're seeing this situation in Ukraine as some, you know, cabal, some plot by people who don't have their best interests at heart. People who are at all familiar with the Hunter Biden case, they understand, like, okay, Hunter Biden makes millions of dollars over in Ukraine, and now we're bankrupting the country for some Jewish oligarch. This doesn't make a great deal of sense. And so those discontentments, those concerns, they're cracking holes in the facade of the Mitch McConnell wing of the Republican Party, and they're creating the opportunity for us to influence the changes as they go on.
I'd like to ask you two gentlemen to prognosticate just a bit. Where do you see our cause? I'm not going to call it the movement. The movement is the personalities. The cause is sacred. It's the preservation and the advancement of our people. Where do you see us in that regard in 5 years? Where do you see us in that regard in 10 years? If you're willing to go beyond that, please feel free. Dr. Hill, I'm going to ask you first, sir. Where do you see this cause of ours in 5 years and then a decade down the line?
Well, by nature, I'm very optimistic. As a Christian, I know that the ultimate victory is already ours. That doesn't mean in the meantime there's not going to be some hard knocks that have to be suffered by people like us. And I don't think the fight's going to be easy, but I think it is going to be successful. In 5 years from now, which will be, almost 2028, I mean, you know, that'll be two presidential elections for what they're worth. With all this election fraud and all that's going on, I don't know. But, you know, I can see the swelling of this movement within a five-year period to one which would have to be taken seriously. We have the battle lines drawn already, I think. It's just that there's still too much middle ground for some people to be able to stand on. And I've said for many, many, many years that when we get to the point where there is no middle ground to stand on, everybody has to choose a side, that we'll win, because our side has history behind it. It has common sense behind it. It has a workable plan behind it. We are white men. We created the greatest civilization the world has ever known and ever will know. We simply have fallen down on the job. And you know, I don't know if y'all remember who Louis Beam was, but I was always a big fan of his. And Louis Beam once said that, you know, if you really want to see who's responsible for the plight that we're in today, just go look in the mirror. White men have not done what we should have done. We've let this happen. And it's very easy to blame it on the Jews and blame it on the Negroes. But I'm certainly not taking anything away from the fault that we could put on their shoulders, but we've let it happen. We had control of this country. We let it slip away for whatever reasons. One generation of whites likes to blame the other, and there's no future in doing that. We all have to work together. But I am very optimistic over the course of 5 years. I can see the Republican Party, and a while ago, I didn't mean to say, Chris, that I wanted to see the GOP go away completely. I would like to see it in its current iteration go away and become a party of a pro-white party, where the Democrat has become an anti-white party. And I can see that maybe happening if things break the right way over the next 4 to 5 years. Over the next 10 years, and I don't know, at age 71, I don't have that many years left. I'd like to think that in 10 years, I'll still be around and kicking. But I'm very positive, very hopeful for the future, because I do see our ideas as reasonable ideas that most common sense people, white folks, can grasp and hold and profit from, prosper with. And I think those things are going to become a necessity. I think we will be pushed to the brink. And at that point, our mettle will be tested as the white race. I don't think we'll fail, because I think we are chosen to be the dominant force in this world. And I think that's why we're under fire like we are and have been. And I think the Jews are the principal catalyst behind that. But I think the Jews' mask has come off and they're beginning to be seen as the monsters that they are. And I do believe that once that happens, that these things will be telescoped and that we'll see a lot of things happen in a hurry. We just have to be patient and keep pushing and not get frustrated at this. But I'm very optimistic about the short-term future as well as the long-term.
Chris?
To what Dr. Hill said about the mask coming off with the Jews, I think of in Mein Kampf, when Hitler said that they parade themselves as a religion, but in reality, they are a race. And two things stand out in my mind just from recent news that Whoopi Goldberg got back into again, this Holocaust wasn't about race line, which had the feature of reminding people that the Jews are a race. And you guys, I forget his name off the top of my head, but some recently elected Republican thought it would help him get elected, and he turned out to be right to go tell people that he was Jewish. And then he says, well, I was raised Catholic, but, you know, I'm Jewish on my mother's side, and this becomes this controversy. And so I think that that mask is coming off of the Jews that that they're parading around as fellow whites, and they're losing that. And I think that portends positive things for the future. You know, what is the future for us? I'd say is a very uncertain question. I would like to set a very modest goal. I think that a modest and achievable goal is by, if not 2024, then the 2026 midterms, let's get Republicans asking for the white vote, that they feel the need to mention white people when they're talking about the various interests that they are promising to fulfill. And if they would simply mention that, I think would be a very achievable outcome. And that might seem modest to the in comparison to an ethno state, but it's achievable. And so I would like to set that very modest goal and dedicate myself towards it. And if we can accomplish that, then I think that that will rapidly accelerate the racial awareness of the population in such a fashion that it no longer works to try to guilt white people into all of the ethno-masochistic nonsense that they've been baited into previously. And if we can do that, then I would say that we'll have to reassess our plans from there. But because beyond that, I don't think we can predict. But I think that that modest goal is achievable and worthy of pursuit.
I'd like to make a request from each of you gentlemen at this point. As we know, there's a great deal in this culture that we've allowed to devolve that discourages a young white man. Pairing off with a young white woman is probably more difficult than it's ever been before because of lots of societal pressures. The prospects for a young white man are probably at their low ebb, really at any point that we can recall. You're each a voice of some note in this thing of ours, and I think we all understand what a white pill is. I'd like you to offer a white pill to the listeners of this dispatch, who many of them are these same young white men that I'm speaking of. Chris, would you be willing to do that, to throw a white pill to the young white men who are listening to this dispatch?
I'll drop a few. You know, I think that there's a very real possibility of us still prevailing in this Charlottesville thing. And while we can count on the media to pay zero attention to that, it provides us with this, again, conduit into these circles in closer proximity to power that I think is very important. You know, anybody with any proximity to power ran from us after the Charlottesville thing. And if we can tell them, look, you know, all they had to do was prove it to a half black jury by a preponderance of the evidence that we did this and we didn't. You know what they're capable of. These people are dishonest. They're dangerous. We're on the same side. And if we can do that even if we lose the Charlottesville case. But if we prevail on a Charlottesville case, we can do it a lot easier. So there's the one thing. And as I alluded to earlier, I think that just to watch it from within prison walls, just to watch it happen on television and listen to happening on the radio without, you know, dissident social media, you know, alternative media platforms. I watched, as did everybody else that I was watching with in the prison, you know, our politics is rapidly changing, and it's changing in a way that is more favorable to us. And if we play our cards right and be the adults in the room, then we will be able to impact that change in ways that are positive to us. But I think that the challenge before us is to set and pursue achievable goals, to show restraint when it is prudent, and to push forward at the right moments. And if we show the wrong restraint or we push at the wrong times, then we imperil ourselves. So there's no certainty. This is not a prediction. It's an opportunity for us that I'm illustrating. And I think that after some of the trouble that has beset us in the last 5 years, you know, an opportunity is its own white pill. We have a meaningful opportunity to alter public policy in a way that is favorable to us and get ourselves or people who are influenced by us in closer to proximity to power. And if we can do that, well, then we can do anything that political power can do. And I would go so far as to say that that's quite a bit. And that makes me feel a whole lot better about the future.
Thank you for that, Chris. Dr. Hill, white pill our young men, sir.
All right. I'd like to do this on a little more personal level, because you mentioned something about the very sad fact that a lot of our young white men are having trouble finding young white women and matching up and making families and making white babies. And we desperately need that for the future. I come from a different generation, obviously, but I think some of these things are applicable no matter what generation you come from. I come from that accursed boomer generation, but I'm always telling these young folks, don't think that all boomers are the same, because we're not. I would like to say this specifically to the young men directly and tangentially to the young women out there who might be listening, because I think it's incumbent upon the man to make the first move. If you're young, take advantage of all the opportunities for adventure that you can get. And sometimes you only have one opportunity to do it. You can't put it off and say, well, I'll come back and do it some other time. If you have the opportunity for an adventure, please do it. Keep yourself in good shape, good physical shape. Eat right, exercise, lift weights. Stay away from junk food, processed food. Eat good, clean food. Drink good, clean water. Don't smoke. Limit your use of alcohol. Take care of yourselves, in other words. Develop your intellect, because I'm telling you that there is nothing that'll turn a woman off any quicker than a dumbass man. Women think intellect is sexy. Develop your intellect, and don't just think you can get by just by developing your biceps. Develop your brain and your body, because you're an integral whole, you know, body, mind, soul, and spirit. Develop all of those things into a package that is attractive to a young woman, and she will find it attractive. I guarantee you that. You need to go out, and obviously one of the drawbacks, I think, for young men today is they spend a lot of time online. They don't have a lot of experience face-to-face time with young women. Get comfortable looking a woman in the eye. And I know that can be uncomfortable for some young guys who've never had much experience with that, but they don't bite. Look them in the eye and speak to them. And if you're sincere, if you have developed yourself into a young man or even an older man who has something to offer them, and specifically provision and protection, that's what a woman wants. A woman wants to be provided for, and she wants to be taken care of. She doesn't want to be your equal. She wants to be compatible with you. don't be afraid of them. It's your role to lead. Become a leader. And you have to do this in small steps. You're going to make some mistakes. You're going to run into some women that might look good, but on the inside, they're not so good. Don't be fooled by that. Look for good women. Look for good women who would be good mothers to your children. They're out there. Seek them and find them. Don't give up. Don't be frustrated. But learn to be a man. And being a man doesn't mean being a bully. Being a man is about, first of all, doing your duty and being responsible. And your first duty is to make sure that you have the things that would attract a young woman to you and want you for a husband and a protector and a provider. And women, when they see that, they will come running to it. Because I think among young men today, that is so rare. But look, don't back off either on your beliefs, because a woman wants a man that's sure not only of himself physically, but emotionally and mentally as well. If you're a white nationalist, a Southern nationalist young man, learn to speak that language to the women that you come into contact with. Some of them will probably say, well, no, that's not for me. But the ones who will listen to you, hey, you may just have found your soulmate for life there. Go out and be aggressive, young men. Find those women, make them your wives, and make families, because that is the future of the white race right there. I don't care where you are, whether you're in the South, the West, in Australia, New Zealand, Europe, Canada, wherever the white man is, that has to be done or our future is in peril.
Yes, sir. The future of our race lives in the wombs of our women. So go forth and multiply, young men. Theo, you mentioned you might have something.
Here at the, you know, in the Manor Bund, we're not a political organization. We're focused on brotherhood, of developing not only people as individuals, but people in their place as in a larger body of a brotherhood of other white men in communities and whatnot. So I like asking this question because it gets some, I get some interesting answers. So I'll ask it of both of you. If you knew tomorrow, whether it be, I don't know, come to you in a dream, God told you, you read it in the stars, that you knew that whatever you think of victory, whatever that is, it's not going to happen. The white race is on the way out and there's basically nothing that can be done about it. Would that change, or what would that change, if anything, in your day-to-day life? And would that change anything in, I don't know, your participation in this struggle, movement, cause, whatever? And if so, how? And if not, why not?
I will. I'll respectfully decline to answer. I wouldn't want to say it in public. I'm
that's fair.
Sorry. I apologize.
It's all good.
I wouldn't change anything I'm doing right now. You know, there's an old poem. I can't remember the exact words. I can't remember who wrote it, but I can remember the basic thrust of it. And that is, I was not asked to win. I was only asked to fight. I wouldn't change anything that I was doing from a general standpoint. I might change a few specific things and become a little bit more, even more radical than I am right now. But I wouldn't know what else to do. I'm not simply going to sit down and accept defeat without a fight. That's just not the way I was created. And it was certainly not the way that my father and mother raised me. I would fight to the last bloody ditch, and I don't care if that ditch was my enemy's ditch or my own. That's all I know to do, and that's exactly what I would do. And I would try to block out of my mind anything but the immediate present duty. And as I've said, I would probably radicalize that a little bit, and I think I understand what Chris was talking about, too. I won't say any more than that.
Theo, I'm not a guest, but I'd like to answer that too. Would you mind?
Please do.
I've always believed in our people, no matter what. I would not accept that that's the irreversible future. I would do everything and anything I could do to change the unwritten history. as Dr. Hill said, and I really can't elaborate on his answer, I don't have any expectation of winning necessarily, but I have every expectation that I'll fight for victory until the final beat of my heart. So I would disregard the carved in stone nature of knowing what's coming and do everything that I could to change that. That's the best answer I can give.
You know, I'll chime back in on the subject here, and I'll invite the listener to draw inferences from what I won't say in public. But as I listen to this, I'm thinking of shortly after the 2020 election, Rush Limbaugh came on the air, and he said, Rush, you told us that you're going to tell us if it's time to panic. And he said, well, it's never going to be time to panic. We're never going to give up. And, he said, we're never going to give up on America, but I'm certainly never going to give up on white people. And so I agree with that sentiment.
Yeah, I do too. History is not written in stone. It's there for men with free will to shape, obviously under the hand of a providential God, but our actions have consequences. I would do the same. I try to put that out of my mind and say, no, I don't accept that verdict at all, and I'm going to fight even harder than I'm fighting right now. But thank God I don't believe that. I think victory is out there for us to grasp.
And I don't think that, I don't think that there is an end point, right? I mean, it is not as though we reach some point of satisfaction on our political pursuits and lay down our arms, so to speak, even if we are, for lack of a better term, successful. Whatever we get, whatever it is that we're aiming for today, then we'll begin to aim for something higher, right? And so if there's some dark period, and I would go so far as to say that, we happen to be in one. But whenever there is, however low we get, there's something up there for us to grab to. And so unless I'm the last white man and there's no more white women, it's not over, And so I don't foresee myself being around to witness anything of that sort. And so that's the thing is there is, I don't think that it is. If you're thinking that there is no future for us, chances are you're wrong, and you would not want to make that a self-fulfilling prophecy, white man.
Yeah, I agree with that. A very wise man who I happen to know once said, and I certainly agree, that we're either going to be the greatest generation of white men who's ever lived, or we're going to be the last. And I certainly don't believe that we're going to be the last. I take it as a great honor to have been born into this conflict that we're in right now and to be able to participate in it. I don't think that there's a better way to spend your life than fighting for the cause of your people and your civilization. And in my case, the God in which I believe. I think that's the greatest honor a man can have. And as a white man, I think this is what you're called to do. I mean, if you're not, you haven't lived, in my opinion. All these generations of white men that have been born in times of peace and plenty, I guess you might say, they may have lived good lives, but I don't think their lives are going to be quite as interesting as ours have been and will be in this fight, because we're certainly in the middle of one. And I'm just like Chris. I think we're going to prevail, and I think we're going to have many, many future generations of prosperous and free white men and women coming after us. So that's just my optimism coming through.
That actually leads me to, well, one of the last questions that I've got, and then we'll sort of open up for anything that we haven't covered that you two gentlemen would like to cover. Total Aryan victory. That's an expression that we hear from time to time. Again, I pose this to each of you by turn. What does total Aryan victory look like to you? Chris, would you like to take that first?
I'll try to respond to what you're saying. I don't know that I can really answer your question, because I don't think such a concept is particularly useful, because as I said prior, if we reached whatever we envision today as total Aryan victory, our minds would immediately conjure the next goal, right? There's not a point of satisfaction at which we stop. And mm-hmm. so I don't agree with this as a concept is my response to it.
I'd be willing to amend that a bit, because I think I understand what you're saying. I'm certain you visualize certain objectives, certain happenings that you would like to see occur. If your hopes and objectives for our people are accomplished, what does that look like?
Well, as I said earlier, I think that an intermediate goal, a modest and achievable one, is to get politicians to, you know, how many times have we heard Donald Trump say, oh, we got black unemployment, Asian unemployment, Hispanic unemployment. He goes on this list of all these racial groups that he helped out. I think that an intermediate achievable goal from which we can reassess our future orientation is to get politicians to do that with white people. And that is something that would, in these circles, that probably sounds very modest, but I think for most people consuming mainstream news, that this would be like, it would blow their mind, right? And so that's where I'm going to focus my attention for now, is to make something like that possible. And if that becomes possible, then I think from there we reorient our vision of the future in such a fashion as to find out what it is that we want next. I mean, my temptation is to say, well, I want a white ethno state in North America. That appeals to me. That's a good goal to obtain. I think that we'd all live a lot happier if, we didn't have other people dragging us down. But that does not seem like an immediately achievable goal. And so I'm disinclined to frustrate myself with its pursuit.
That's fair. You know, before Dr. Hill tackles that in whatever form he'd care to, I'd like to circle back just a little bit, because something you said, it jarred a recollection of something I had intended to bring up when we were discussing the Republican Party. Agreed, the Republican Party in its current form doesn't serve our purposes at all. They're really just Democrats who have a different letter after their name. If the Republican Party were legally rid of the Mitch McConnells, the Lindsey Grahams, et cetera, that list goes on, Lisa Murkowski et al., and it actually became a real right-wing political party that also represented the views of white people, do you believe that would give us a good step toward overcoming the media, which is entirely leftist in its orientation and not coincidentally controlled, managed, and owned by one demographic group overwhelmingly? Do you think a Republican Party in that form could be effective for our interests?
I do have, the Republican Party is, like any party, is just a vehicle. And when I use the Republican Party as an example there, it just happens to be the one that most white people are a part of today. And I don't see that changing in the foreseeable future. So I just want to make it clear that, you know, I've never been a Republican or never been a Democrat, never been anything really. Yeah, I do believe that if you had a white people's party, regardless of what you called it, that a lot of things would change. I think, as Chris pointed out earlier too, that Trump's greatest accomplishment, that I think he believes and I believe both, is that he destroyed people's faith in the mainstream legacy media by calling it fake news, and that's the first thing that comes into people's minds today when they hear CNN or MSNBC or ABC, et cetera. That is fake news. I think the media is already on its way out. What replaces it? I don't know who will be controlling it. I'm sure the Jews will try. But I think a political party that would admit that it was there to serve the interests of white people would change the political landscape in a revolutionary way. And I don't know what would come of that, but I think it would be very good.
All right. I understand. Well, at this point, we've covered a pretty wide range of topics. It's been a heck of a discussion today. Chris, is there a particular topic or any matter at all that we didn't get to that you had hoped we would?
You know, I'll just pick up on what we were saying about the Republican Party. I read Pat Buchanan's Suicide of a Superpower while I was in prison, and I was surprised. It's interesting. I mean, it borders on advocacy of ethno-nationalism, and I was surprised to hear that coming from Pat Buchanan. He's got a chapter titled The White People's Party. And, you know, I was left to think about, you know, what if this guy had become president? Again, that was not something that was, didn't happen, but it wouldn't have been the craziest thing in the world. And so I think that we are much closer to something like that happening than a lot of us are probably inclined to believe. And it's just a matter of playing our cards right. It's a matter of playing the game of power, getting in proximity to influencing and finding these conduits, you know, influencing the people who are already in proximity to power, and then thereby increasing our proximity. And if we can do that, then we are limited only by what political power can do. And that is not limitless by any stretch of the imagination, but it's certainly possible. And so that's a thought.
Chris, do you know who likely would have been Pat Buchanan's chief political advisor had he become president?
Who's that?
Dr. Sam Francis. Are you familiar with him?
The name rings a bell, but I don't know if I could pick him out of a lineup.
Yeah, well, he unfortunately passed away about 15 years ago, but check out his work, Samuel Francis. Sam was a friend of mine. We were both in the John Randolph Club together, and I greatly admired him. He was a very, very forward-thinking man and a champion of the white race, and it's a shame he's not around to see what's the advances I think that we're making today. But he had Pat's ear, and I think that's one reason Pat was went down the path he went.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. It's we have opportunities to do this, you know, and these opportunities have been there before and they've had some influence, and it's just a matter of, you know, keeping on doing that. You know, me personally, I had previously had, I don't want to say revolutionary, but, you know, a mold bug reset sort of idea that, you know, the idea is to, you know, fire the government and replace it in one fell swoop sort of concepts. And I have been, over time, I've been disabused of that notion. And so finding ways to influence people to move in a gradual direction, I think is where my mind is oriented at this point. And the opportunities that we've had, the successes that we've had, those things are worth studying, and I'll take a look at the work of Mr. Francis.
I think you'll like what you see.
Beautiful Losers, I think. That's right. Was a really good work. Yeah.
Yes, it was. Absolutely. Yeah. Sam was a bit, I always enjoyed reading his work. He was always out there, and he was fearless. He lost his job on more than one occasion because of his outspokenness. Another fellow who had Pat's ear too was Joe Sobrin. I don't know if y'all are familiar with Joe, but he was very much like Pat, like Sam Francis. Two men that I wish were still around.
I'd like to share with you a quote attributed to Pat Buchanan. I've had this saved for quite some time, and it was very easy to find because I had it in a file that I look at often. Here's the quote. "We may deny the existence of ethno-nationalism, detest it, and condemn it, but this creator and destroyer of empires and nations is a force infinitely more powerful than globalism, for it engages the heart. Men will die for it. Religion, race, culture, and tribe are the four horsemen of the coming apocalypse."
I think that may have been, he may have written that in Suicide of a Superpower. If not, he wrote something very similar to it in that. And he sort of went over this history of the world that, like, you know, it is ethno-nationalism that has actually driven much of world affairs. And, you know, in the post-World War II American information matrix, that consciousness is suppressed. But it is a powerful force, as you say, and Mr. Buchanan was certainly aware of that.
No, that's exactly why I think we're going to win, is because nature is on our side.
I'll delve for just a moment into one of the reasons, at least, why that's not such a driving force at this point. I think it lurks right below the surface, but I think a great deal of effort has been put into suppressing that in the heart of a white man, because there's a particular group that they manage, own, and control the media. That's just not even in dispute. And because they've appointed themselves as moral arbiters of our time due to an event that either did or didn't happen about 70 years ago, that's held as a cudgel over the rest of the planet to guilt us into giving up our natural instincts. Our natural instincts are for ethno-nationalism. That's in the heart of a white man. That's one of the things I believe four square. This particular group of people is scared to death of nationalism on any level because they've been rootless wanderers since the beginning of time. And anytime they find themselves in a culture or a society that hews to nationalist and certainly ethno-nationalist values, they're seen for what they are, and they're ejected, which has been done 109 times throughout history. Those shackles will be thrown off. I won't go any deeper into this event that did or didn't happen 80 years ago, but I think as time passes, that's going to stop being such an effective bludgeon on the heart and instincts of a white man.
I certainly think that that's happening as we speak. I mean, you know, even the... in the United States, I'd go so far as to say that this line of slavery as America's original sin is a lot more deeply rooted in the consciousness of white Americans than this event to which you refer. And Americans, at least, even without questioning the historicity of the event in question, they don't feel any particular they have less cause to than anybody else feel any guilt about that. And so when they are beat up over the head over this, as if they owe somebody something for this event, I don't think that that's going to continue holding the sway that it does, because they're even beginning to throw off this, you know, I never owned a slave. What are you talking about? Well, you know, I certainly didn't march us off to gas chambers. You know, my grandfather may very well have died fighting for this, you know? And so that doesn't seem to, I don't think that it's tenable for that to hold the sway that it does in the long term.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. I truly do. But I do hold a firm opinion about that event, but I don't know that it's necessarily where we want to go on the dispatch.
That's a different episode.
I'll have you back for that episode if you like, and we'll really get into that, because I definitely have an opinion about it. Well, Dr. Hill, I'd thrown it out there just a moment ago. Is there any topic you had in mind that you'd hope we'd get to today that we didn't get to?
Oh, man, I thought we were going to be able to talk about the Hola hoax for a while, but I guess that is for another
program. Well, I think we demonstrated what we believe in a particular video a couple of years ago, Dr. Hill.
I was about to say, you know, last time I looked, that thing had several million views.
Yeah, you know, the nature of hosting a dispatch that represents an organization, sometimes an individual's views are best maybe left unexpressed.
Right, exactly.
You know.
No, I would just like to say that my vision of victory, first and foremost, would be a free and independent South, since I'm a Southern nationalist, but I would like to see that for every white polity out there, you know, all the other regions of North America that the white man dominates, South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, and certainly all of Europe as being white man's land again. That's how I would view the overall victory. But I do agree with Chris's sentiment there too. You know, history is not static. You know, it's always evolving and changing. And once you get to one point, everything is just not all of a sudden set in stone forever. You have to preserve what you've accomplished. And that preservation usually means being at least on guard against what your enemies, and you will always have enemies, are going to do. So there's never any rest. You can't just finally sit back and put your feet up, put your hands behind your head and have a drink and say it's all over. That's the recipe for it coming all undone. But as a temporary thing, I would like to see us regain control of the areas that once we referred to as white man's land.
Couldn't agree more. We'd like to thank you for being with us on this 2023 inaugural broadcast of the Manorbund Dispatch. I'm Odysseus, your host, with Theo, our co-host and producer. Thank you again for being with us. Strength and honor.
Strength and honor.
Nothing left but the fire in my chest and the air that fills my lungs. I'll hold my tears and trade my years for a glimpse at kingdom come. On the other side of misery, there's a world we long to see. The strife we share will take us there to relief and sovereignty.
To see.